From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. During the filming of Apocalypse Now, Eleanor Coppola accused her husband of creating his own Vietnam. She should know she was on the set making a documentary about the epic her husband was directing. Now you can see her footage in movie theaters. On today's Fresh Air, Eleanor Coppola on the making of Apocalypse Now. The Cold War is over, but weapons sales continue. Michael Clare, defense correspondent for The Nation, discusses the economic and political pressures to sell weapons to the Third World. And with the Super Bowl approaching, linguist Jeffrey Nunberg compares the language of football and baseball. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A judge in San Salvador today sentenced an Army colonel and a lieutenant to 30 years in prison for their role in murdering six Jesuit priests, their housekeeper, and her daughter in 1989. The judge also imposed suspended sentences of 3 years on three other officers, including a lieutenant colonel found guilty of destroying evidence. This marks the first time in El Salvador that an Army officer has been convicted of a politically motivated human rights violation. President Bush today blamed what he called arrogance among banking regulators for a credit crunch that is hampering the housing industry. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
In anticipation of his State of the Union speech on Tuesday, the president has been addressing various interest groups and dropping hints about his long-awaited economic action plan. Today, in a teleconference with a group of home builders in Las Vegas, Mr. Bush confirmed his plan will include new tax credits for first-time homebuyers, expanded IRAs, a capital gains tax cut, and the restoration of passive loss deductions for the real estate industry. Mr. Bush also said the housing industry was being shackled by overzealous banking regulators.
We will continue to struggle against this concept of overregulation. Some report to me arrogance on the part of some regulators, and we're trying very hard to sensitize these people.
The president says he believes that economic recovery is right around the corner if Congress approves his action plan. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
The Russian parliament today approved an austere budget that will cut military spending to one-seventh of its past level and is likely to cause massive unemployment. The BBC's Kevin Connolly reports.
The principal architect of the Russian economic reform program, Igor Gaidar, described his own budget as tough and conservative. It calls for a dramatic cut in weapons procurement and sweeping reductions in industrial subsidies, which by some estimates could help send unemployment up from almost nothing to 6 or 7 million in a matter of months. Mr. Gaidar said Russia had no extra sources of income on which to call and had to balance its budget if it was to cut inflation, which the government says might reach 400% by the end of March. He warned that Russia now depended on imported grain and said foreign countries would supply aid only if they saw evidence that reform was going ahead. But the budget, which Parliament in the end approved, did not escape criticism. The chairman of the Budget Commission, Alexander Pochinok, warned that the government's determination to cut the budget deficit would hurt the army, damage industry, and bring with it the threat of political instability.
Kevin Connolly reporting. Billionaire Lawrence Tisch and the Lowe's Corporation he controls have broken off talks late this evening over the possible acquisition of R.H. Macy & Company. The end of the talks leaves Macy facing a large payment owed to suppliers tomorrow. Stocks gained 6 points on Wall Street today to close at 32.32. This is NPR. A federal judge today accepted a guilty plea by the Bank of Credit and Commerce International to racketeering. BCCI will now forfeit $550 million of its assets, the largest single criminal payment in American history. The agreement calls for about half the sum to be used to prop up BCCI's main U.S. subsidiary, First American Bank Shares. The rest of the money will be used to pay off overseas creditors, civil fines, and penalties in the United States. BCCI had been accused of secretly acquiring four U.S. banking institutions and laundering drug proceeds to Panama and elsewhere. The National Council on Education Standards and Testing proposed that U.S. schools adopt new, rigorous academic standards for elementary and high school students. The standards cover English, math, science, history, and geography. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
The plan would work this way. Experts would come together to draft a new, more demanding set of benchmarks for what students should know in each subject. Teachers across the country would be given a chance to review and comment. Employers would be asked to judge the new standards for the workplace. The final guidelines would then be offered to states, and a new series of tests would be developed to measure student achievement. The American Federation of Teachers today praised the plan as a revolutionary breakthrough. Education Secretary Lamar Alexander said the plan calls for a massive retraining of teachers. But test makers said the council was rushing towards tests that don't exist yet. When and if they do, they'll be 10 times more expensive. The Association of American Publishers said the entire process threatens to override local education reform efforts. The council's plan now goes to Congress, the U.S. Department of Education, and National Education Goals Panel. I'm Claudio Sanchez in Washington.
Hollywood child star Freddie Bartholomew, who starred in David Copperfield in the 1930s, has died of emphysema. Born in Dublin, Ireland, he started his acting career at age 4 when living with an aunt. He was later discovered by MGM and went on to become one of Hollywood's highest-paid child stars. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The makers of the 1979 Vietnam epic Apocalypse Now were said to have run into some of the same problems that faced the men who fought the war. Once they got in, they got deeper and deeper and couldn't pull themselves out. A new documentary called Hearts of Darkness, A Filmmaker's Apocalypse, shows how director Francis Coppola dealt with recreating jungle warfare in the Philippines during a real civil war. There were times Coppola was sure he could not make a movie out of his increasingly incoherent footage.
What I have to admit is that I don't know what I'm doing.
Well, how do you account for the discrepancy between what you feel about it and what everybody else who sees it?
Because they see the magic of what has happened before. I'm saying, hey, it's not going to happen. I don't have any performances. The script doesn't make sense. I have no ending. I'm like a voice crying out, saying, please, it's not working. Somebody get me off this. And nobody listens to me. Everyone says, yes, well, Francis works best in a crisis. I'm saying this is one crisis I'm not going to pull myself out of. I'm making a bad movie, so why should I go ahead? I'm going to be bankrupt anyway. Why can't I just have the courage to say it's no good?
The documentary footage shot during the making of Apocalypse Now was directed by Eleanor Coppola, Francis's wife, at his request. It sat on a shelf until a couple of years ago when two young producers asked to use the footage. They added new interviews with the filmmakers and actors. Their documentary, Hearts of Darkness, played on Showtime and is now opening in movie theaters. My guest is Eleanor Coppola. Her journal, Notes on the Making of Apocalypse Now, has just been published in a new edition. During the filming of Apocalypse Now, Francis Coppola orchestrated spectacular recreations of the American bombing of Vietnam. I wondered what it felt like to be in the middle of a phony war.
Well, I found it really exhilarating. You know, it's like the most incredible 4th of July kind of a light show with these, you know, enormous explosions, and the earth shook like an earthquake. There were huge, particularly the napalm attack, and the scene with Colonel Kilgore, Robert Duvall, was just a powerful event to be there. It was just your whole body felt the concussion and this enormous, you know, whatever it was, 10,000 gallons of fuel was lit and exploded in the jungle. And I really found it extraordinary, and I think sometimes that even annoyed Francis, that he was trying to get his work done and everybody else was kind of at a light show.
One of the stories that the movie gets into, the documentary on the making of Apocalypse Now, is how Francis Coppola used helicopters from the Philippine Army because the United States Army wouldn't cooperate with the making of a movie about Vietnam. But the government kept wanting the helicopters back to fight a civil war against communist insurgents. Tell us some of the ways that kept disrupting the shooting of Apocalypse Now.
It was a very disruptive situation because the Army would send out their helicopters and whatever pilots they wanted to send out, and the pilots would be different every day, so they hadn't rehearsed. They didn't realize what it was like to fly in through filming situations, and they would sometimes they'd fly too high and they wouldn't be in the camera shot, or they just wouldn't realize what was involved in really performing for the camera, so to speak. So they would lose many shots because the pilots wouldn't be flying in the right place to be seen in the camera. And then the next day, by the time they finally learned how to do it, the next day they'd send different pilots. And then very frequently they would call the planes away. They'd be all set up for a shot. Everyone would be out there on the location shooting, and they would get some radio communication that that four of the helicopters had to leave for military reasons, or some days all of the helicopters, or some days they would be out there ready to work and expecting eight helicopters to be provided, and only two would show up. So it was a very difficult part of the production, and it cost tens and tens of thousands of dollars in lost footage and waiting for the helicopters to come that never came.
And there were guards at your house because Marcos was afraid that rebels would kidnap you and Francis Coppola for publicity?
Yes, they had some idea that if Francis would be kidnapped for some political reasons by the insurgents, that it would create an international incident and bring attention to the Philippines and unwanted attention, so that they provided us right from the beginning with guards, personal bodyguards. I actually felt more concerned finally that the guards might cause some accident. They got very casual about their weapons. Our main bodyguard had just would stick his pistol in his belt of his blue jeans, and he'd get it out and show the kids how it worked. And he had a trunk full of shotguns and other, I don't know what, other guns and things in the trunk of the car. And it just seemed like I was really in more danger of some accident from the bodyguards than I really was in danger from insurgents.
I could see how that would not be very reassuring.
No, and I'm there with three children, and yeah. and in the casualness of the weapons that the guards had was really a concern to me.
When Marlon Brando arrived on the set to play Kurtz, Francis Coppola didn't realize that Brando was going to be as heavy as he was. How did that affect the way the role was conceived?
Well, when Francis realized that he was not slimmed down and able to play the Green Beret that he was originally committed to the part for, that Francis had to decide what to do in the situation. And his first idea was to play Marlon as an indulging, mango-eating, over-indulging himself here in the jungle in this situation, and just play him sort of overweight and his uniform not really fitting properly, and just go with that whole kind of look. And Marlon did not want to do that. He just was unwilling to do that. So then Francis was really at a loss. What could he do then if he wouldn't do that? So the two of them sat down for days talking about what part he could play and how they could resolve the ending of this movie. And they at one point came up with this very theatrical, larger-than-life personage that's you see, just emerging from the darkness and the light, and you never really fully see him as a reality. He's much more of a sort of an archetypical, mythical figure. And that was sort of a new approach for Brando, because he was known for his great, reality, the grittiness of his realness and his performances, so that he struggled with that too. And the two of them had a real head-to-head go there trying to resolve the ending of the film.
A lot of Marlon Brando's part was improvised. There's some really interesting footage in Hearts of Darkness of Brando improvising. Would you describe a little bit the process that he and Francis Coppola used to improvise the part?
Well, they would come up with some actual lines and some of the dialogue that Marlon was to say, but the way Marlon works is he has to find a reality, so he would then put those lines into kind of a just a sort of free form, improvising and talking as he went along through the part. So they had definite points that he was supposed to make, and he then kind of created around those points and kind of gives it that that reality. Because one of the things he does, he, for instance, will like write a line on his hand or put it on a piece of tape on one of the props nearby so that he sort of has to look for that line and sort of give it that little edge of struggle that, just like we have in our own conversation, I don't know exactly what line I'm going to say next, and it gives my voice a kind of edgy reality because I'm sort of fishing for what the next line is going to be. And he does that. It's part of his technique to not learn his lines and just spit them out slickly, but to really just have to have that little edge of reaching for them.
It sounds from the footage you shot that one of the techniques that they'd use to improvise was that Francis Coppola would ask Marlon Brando questions off camera, and then Brando would have to respond to the questions, and the camera would be rolling as he responded.
Yes, that's right.
Why are we in Vietnam?
It's our time to grab this moment in history. It's our time to teach. Huh? I can't think of any more dialogue today.
Dennis Hopper played the part of a really drugged-out American journalist in Vietnam. When he was cast in this role, he already had the reputation for being genuinely drugged out and burned out. And there's some terrific footage in the documentary of him and Francis Coppola talking together and trying to like work out what the part's going to be. And Coppola wants to know how come he doesn't know his lines yet. Why did Coppola even bring on Dennis Hopper? And I'm a really big fan of Hopper's asking this question, but he was in such bad shape then. You know, you wonder, why would you ask for this kind of trouble?
Well, I don't think Francis actually realized he was in that kind of shape. He thought he was a really good actor, and he had a lot of admiration for him, and he was cast in a role, a Green Beret role, and when he really got out there, Francis realized there's no way that he could play this the Green Beret, and he had to then sort of invent a part for him because he thought he was very talented and there must be some way to use his gifts. And so Francis has the great ability to make the part fit the actor rather than the other way around. If the actor comes and can't play the part as written, he rewrites the part. And he certainly did that in Dennis's case, and tried to somehow utilize the character that he was, because that was one of the issues in the Vietnam War, is the use of drugs and the availability of drugs. And in fact, there in the Philippines, because of where we were there in Asia, there were drugs available and cheaply, and things that aren't available just here in while everybody's home in Los Angeles, so that there was experimentation among the people who were out there. And Dennis, of course, was just really far out at that moment. In fact, he looks back at that period and is pretty astounded himself, I think.
Why did you say that to him in the scene?
Who?
Something clever like that. When he says, "Who are you?" Why did you say, "Who are you?"
Because I haven't learned my lines yet.
I know you've had them for 5 days.
The other thing I'd like to say is that
these glasses,
I can't see anything through them. But like, you know, every crack represents a life I've saved. You know what I mean? They represent a life I've saved.
You say that all out in the scene.
I do, but you see, the director says, you don't know your lines. And then, like,
well,
you know,
if you know your lines, then you can forget them.
Oh,
you know more or less.
I see. But that's what I'm trying to do. Forget those lines.
No, but it's not fair to forget them if you never knew them.
During the making of Apocalypse Now, you sent your husband a telex telling him he was becoming like Kurtz, and creating his own Vietnam with his supply of wines and steaks and air conditioners. And you send copies of this telex to the set designer, the cinematographer, and the production manager. Why did you do that? I mean, something had must have really been working on you for you to not only telex Francis, but to telex the people who he worked with.
Well, at that moment, in my opinion, I was really concerned that the whole thing was going too far and had the potential of tipping over the edge. And that was just my response to the situation at that point in time. And now we're looking back at it, and so it doesn't seem so appropriate. But in the intensity of the moment, that was the moment where I just felt I had to speak out and give my opinion. All throughout this project, it kept going closer and closer and closer to the edge, it seemed like. And in fact, I felt the forces and the pressure on Francis were so profound that I was very worried that he wouldn't be able to withstand all of those pressures. That was my one, really deep and major concern, is that somehow it would just push him over the edge in some way. And in fact, he did collapse at one point and faint. And there was a moment where I was concerned, that he might have a nervous breakdown or something. But he is a strong person, and after a couple of days, he was able to get his strength back and get his balance back and go on with the project and complete it. But there were some very scary moments there.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Eleanor Coppola, and she shot a lot of footage during the making of Apocalypse Now about the making of the movie, and that footage has been made into a documentary film called Hearts of Darkness, which has been opening theatrically around the country. And the journals that she kept during the making of the movie were published a few years ago. They've just been brought out in a new edition called Notes on the Making of Apocalypse Now. We're going to take a short break, then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Eleanor Coppola, and we're talking about the making of Apocalypse Now. Are you still on the set now when your husband makes a movie, or do you prefer to be off of it?
Well, up through Godfather 3, the whole family went to the locations with Francis on all of his films. We lived there. We put our kids in school there. We lived our life in the... like a circus family going with the productions wherever they went. And it's just been in the last year that my daughter has left home, and she's 20 now, and our lives have changed to a certain extent so that I don't have to be there with the children making a family home on a location. And Frances is shooting now in Los Angeles. It's the first time that I haven't really been there on quite a regular basis. I've had the freedom to come and go and maintain some of the threads of my own life.
How does it feel?
Well, it's a new experience. It's a new freedom, and after 28 years of living your life one way, it's quite an adjustment to shift. And I'm excited. I'm very excited about the future, and I'm also, there's probably part of me grieving for the unity of the family and the structure and sort of being told where we're going to be next rather than having to have the freedom to make those choices myself. So it's mixed, but I'm excited about my freedom, so to speak.
Do you feel shut out at all?
No, Francis is very, makes it very available to me. If I chose to, I could spend every day of my life on his set, and it's just not, it's something that I think that I have to move on with my own life and not be as engrossed in what he's doing. But I'm there a lot. Our son is shooting the second unit on the film. Francis is currently shooting a classic version of Dracula from the Bram Stoker novel, and they're shooting in Los Angeles on big sound stages. And our son, Roman, is shooting the second unit, and so I'm in Los Angeles a lot with them. Our daughter is going to school in Los Angeles, and we're We're very much, we have the Italian Sunday dinner together.
There's an entry in your journals where you say that people, are, you know, when you write a check or give a credit card, people always want to know, oh, are you related to Francis Coppola? And when you, they find out that you're married, they're always, you know, a little bit flustered. And you say you sometimes wonder, like, what did they expect to see? Did they expect Francis Coppola's wife to be a Playboy bunny? do you feel that way a lot, that people have this expectation that any, like, famous director is going to have this young sex pot type wife, fashion model?
Yes, you know, it's... It does seem to sort of be the cliche of, you know, what the film director's wife or partner is going to look like and be like. And somehow, though, over the years, I've sort of gotten the impression that people have sort of come to the realization that Francis has the same wife. Oftentimes he introduces me as his first wife, you know, that... that, you know, we have been together all these years. It's actually going to be 29 years next week. And yet recently I've done some interviews and I realize that the person interviewing me says, oh, I didn't realize you were still married. And so I guess that my kind of low-key, laid-back, willing to be kind of invisible in the shadow of things has really in a certain sense not... fully given a picture of what our life is like, but we are very much a family and a married couple, and it's, I guess it does come as a surprise to some people who see the typical Hollywood family as one of many marriages and kids that are mixed up. I'm really very satisfied and pleased that our kids are solid and centered and creative and haven't really taken any blows from the way our life has been lived, and they've been able to actually gain from all the travel and the experiences, and it's enriched them, I think, and I really feel that it was all worth everything to have my kids turn out in a solid, centered way.
I have one question that I realize might be too personal, so let me ask it and feel free to tell me it's too personal or that it's whatever, okay? You have a son who was killed in an accident, and I was wondering if his death, in a way, made it even more important for the family to stay together.
Well, when there is a death in the family, it creates a complete crisis within the family, and... Actually, the statistics are that 92% of marriages break up when there's a death of a child. So it is a time of perhaps the most extreme crisis. And knowing that, I sought help, and the family really went through their crisis, you know, we all together. And I think that we've come out the other side with the... yes, even a deeper closeness.
Well, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It's really a pleasure to have an opportunity to talk to you.
Eleanor Coppola shot the documentary footage on the making of Apocalypse Now, which you can see in the new movie Hearts of Darkness. Her journal, Notes on the Making of Apocalypse Now, has been published in a new edition by Limelight Editions. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
What did they tell you? They told me that you had gone totally insane. And that your methods were unsound.
Are you an assassin?
I'm a soldier.
You're neither. You're an errand boy, sent by grocery clerks to collect a bill.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. What's the state of the world arms market after the collapse of the Soviet Union? Michael Clare says it's business as usual. Clare is the defense correspondent for The Nation. He reports that although we've pledged to restrain arms sales, we're still negotiating billions of dollars in weapons sales. We'll talk about why. It's just about kickoff time for the Super Bowl, yet you won't find great American writers waxing poetic about the game like they do about baseball. Why not? Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg thinks it's the language of football. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In El Salvador, a judge has sentenced two army officers to 30 years in jail in connection with the murder of six priests, their housekeeper and her daughter, more than 2 years ago. Three other military officers were given suspended sentences in the case. However, their sentences mean that they will now have to leave the army. In Algeria, Islamic fundamentalist political leaders have defied a ban on political speeches in some of the nation's largest mosques. The military-backed government had warned leaders of the Islamic Salvation Front not to use these gatherings for political purposes. Jackie Rowland filed this report for the BBC.
In the fundamentalist strongholds of Kuba and Bab el-Oued, there was a tense atmosphere. Troops and riot police, backed up by water cannons, sealed off the principal mosques and pushed back the crowds of people gathered nearby to hear Islamic leaders speak. In Bab el-Oued, there was at least one heavy-duty machine gun aimed towards the mosque. In nearby streets, riot police fired warning shots into the air to try to make people leave the area. But the crowd only dispersed after an intervention by the mayor of Bab el-Oued. At Kuba, one of the principal leaders of the Islamic Salvation Front, Mr. Mohammed Said, described the country's new leader, Mr. Boudiaf, as a puppet brought in by the army to disguise what was really happening. He accused the army of pointing its guns at fellow Muslims. But he reassured his followers, saying, "God is with us and our aim will be realized."
Jackie Rowland in Algiers. A UN mission has been set to investigate whether conditions in Croatia are right for the deployment of peacekeeping troops. Jason Fear reports from Zagreb.
United Nations representative Marek Golding is scheduled to arrive in Croatia tomorrow on a mission to determine whether the current ceasefire has brought an end to the fighting. The UN Security Council has demanded that a definitive ceasefire be in effect as a condition for the dispatch of peacekeeping forces. While Golding will undoubtedly find signs of progress, he is unlikely to report that hostilities have ended. There have been frequent outbreaks of fighting since the ceasefire took effect 3 weeks ago, and the incidents continued today as the Croatian government lodged a protest over what it charged were numerous violations of Croatian airspace by federal warplanes. There were also reports of artillery attacks by federal troops in eastern and central Croatia early this morning. For National Public Radio, I'm Jason Fear in Zagreb.
In New York City, talks have broken off between billionaire Lawrence Tisch and R.H. Macy & Company, apparently ending attempts by Tisch to acquire the troubled retailing concern. Lowe's Corporation, controlled by Tisch, said that a major Macy's creditor had rejected a substantial equity infusion of cash by Lowe's. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 6 points to close at 3,232.78 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The Bush administration has warned Cuban exiles that those who launch attacks on Cuba from the United States will be prosecuted. A State Department spokeswoman says any efforts to use the U.S. to prepare or promote violence in Cuba is condemned. Three exiles were caught last month trying to get to the island by sea and reportedly were carrying explosives. The State Department has denied Cuban allegations that the three were acting on behalf of the U.S. government. A writer who questions the history of the Nazi Holocaust has had his ideas published in Ohio. The student newspaper at Ohio State University today reprinted his revisionist view of the Holocaust, and that sparked a protest. Bill Cohen of Ohio Public Radio reports.
About 100 students sat in at the OSU Journalism School. They were upset the OSU Lantern reprinted a column by Holocaust revisionist Bradley Smith unedited. His article said the idea that 6 million Jews were murdered in gas chambers is, quote, a PR campaign. Protesters called Smith's claims garbage and said the newspaper's editor should resign. Some protesters said their own parents were survivors of Nazi death camps. Others charged the article would spark a rise in anti-Semitic and racist violence. But Lantern editors and advisors defended their actions. They stressed Smith's article was outnumbered by 8 other stories, editorials, cartoons, and photographs describing the Holocaust as real and Smith as a racist. For National Public Radio, this is Bill Cohen in Columbus.
In Germany, parliament members have warned that dozens of unsafe nuclear power plants pose a threat in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. Members of the government coalition parties called for a worldwide assistance program to help repair faulty nuclear power stations. But at the same time, opposition Social Democrats called for all 60 plants in the region to be closed. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. When it comes to arms sales, the U.S. may be sending out a mixed message. It's pledged to restrain arms sales, but it's still negotiating multi-billion-dollar arms deals. Michael Clare writes about this in the current issue of The Nation. He's their defense correspondent and is an associate professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College. We called him today to discuss some of the latest arms developments of the post-Cold War era. The Pentagon just proposed suspending production of new weapon systems. The plan calls for continuing research and development of prototypes, but the actual production of the weapons would be postponed until a crisis seemed imminent. This plan would dramatically change the defense industry.
The main significance, of course, is for American defense contractors because they won't be able to count on the revenue that would come from going into full-scale production of these weapons. And that will mean a drop in income, and it'll probably mean further layoffs for employees of these firms. So the main impact will be economic, and it will be felt domestically.
What's the Pentagon's reasoning?
The Pentagon's reasoning is that with the end of the Cold War and the virtual disappearance of the threat from the Soviet Union, we don't need to keep producing new and ever more sophisticated and capable weapons because we're not going to be facing an enemy that continually upgrades its weapons. The Soviet threat is more or less frozen where it is now, and it's not likely to develop further. So we don't have to engage in a continuous arms race of ever greater, more sophisticated technology.
You know, it's unusual, isn't it, to read about the Pentagon initiating its own cutbacks?
Well, given the circumstances, it's not so surprising. They know that right now we're in a tremendous economic recession here in this country and that Congress is looking for ways in an election year to seem responsive to constituent concerns about the economy. And they know that the Pentagon budget is a ripe target for sources of funds that can be transferred to other programs, for domestic programs. So what the Pentagon is doing is something like a preemptive strike. They're saying to Congress, we're going to make our own cutbacks, so we don't need you to come in and tell us what to do. We'll do it our way, and that way we'll get the best end of the deal under the circumstances.
I guess this really puts Congress on the spot because there are a lot of jobs on the line in weapons manufacturing. It's always been a dilemma, I think, even for people who support ending the arms race. What happens to all the people who were employed by it?
Yes, this certainly will be a problem for Congress people who come from districts with large defense contractors. In Connecticut, for instance, in our area here, United Technologies just announced significant cutbacks, and that will certainly have an impact on the Connecticut economy. And we see the same thing in California and Texas and St. Louis, areas with large defense contractors. They will feel the heat.
As the Pentagon cuts back on its contracts for arms production, are U.S. arms manufacturers turning more to the world market?
This has historically been the experience that when domestic defense spending declines, American defense contractors will seek to increase their sales to foreign markets. And we see a lot of evidence of that today with the current slowdown in American spending, American defense contractors are working very hard to drum up new business abroad, especially in the Middle East and in the Far East and the Pacific Rim area.
How much independence do arms manufacturers have in America in pursuing clients abroad? What kind of restrictions do they have to work under?
Defense contractors have a pretty free hand in going out to promote new business. There are limitations. There are things they're not allowed to sell, like nuclear weapons and nuclear technology, and there are certain markets that are off limits, like Libya and Syria and Iraq and Iran and so forth. But those restrictions aside, American companies are allowed and do engage in a wide variety of marketing procedures and efforts to drum up new business.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. We'll get into the international arms market. My guest is Michael Clare. He's an associate professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College, and he's the defense correspondent for The Nation. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Michael Clare is with us, and in the current edition of The Nation, he writes about the international arms market. In London, the United States and other members of the UN Security Council pledged to restrain arms sales. In your current article in The Nation, you make the point that there's two contradictory influences at work here. On the one hand, you know, the United States is pledging to restrain arms sales. On the other hand, you've got all these defense contractors looking for new markets abroad.
That's quite right. We're in a funny position here where the end of the Cold War is welcome news for many of us around the world, but on the other hand, it does dry up the market for many weapons producers, and therefore they're putting a lot of pressure on their governments to permit increased sales to the Third World. And that, of course, is the area where we've seen a lot of conflict recently. So while we'll have a reduced level of conflict in Europe with the end of the Cold War, it could result in pressures to sell more weapons to the Middle East, where we can see an increase in conflict, possibly.
Would you describe for us the agreement that the United States reached with the other members of the UN Security Council recently in London?
These were the talks of the so-called Big Five, the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, and they've been meeting since July to work out a series of guidelines for the conduct of arms sales. Now, this is not an agreement in the sense of a treaty where we're bound by the language. Rather, it's an agreement where each one of the parties to it agrees on their own to restrain their arms sales in certain ways, not to sell weapons that are very sophisticated to areas of conflict where it could spur an arms race, not to sell weapons that have an offensive character, like long-range bombers or other weapons that could be used to ignite a regional conflict, and also not to sell to countries that are at war. So these are very sound guidelines and could help restrain the arms trade, but there's nothing in this agreement that requires the governments that signed it to take specific steps to implement them.
Do you think that the United States has political reasons to continue selling a lot of arms, or perhaps even to sell more arms than it did before?
The United States has both political and economic reasons for selling more weapons to its friends in the Middle East. I think in the wake of the Persian Gulf crisis and the kind of alliances we forged with countries in the area, the Bush administration is very eager to retain close and friendly ties with some of those countries, countries like Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and of course our long-term ally Israel. And these countries want more sophisticated weapons. They want the kind of weapons that we used to win the Persian Gulf War. And therefore, the president is under a lot of pressure to supply them with these sophisticated weapons.
So which instinct do you think is going to win out, the one to restrain arms sales or the one to keep selling or sell more?
My impression is that under the circumstances, the pressures to sell are going to outweigh the pressures to restrain arms sales. I say that because of the economic situation that we talked about earlier. That is to say, with the decline in defense spending within the United States and the pain that American defense contractors are going to experience, they're going to put a lot of pressures on the president to allow increased sales abroad to take up some of the slack. And I think that the president is going to bow to some of these pressures. In fact, we've seen evidence of that with the administration's willingness to help American companies market their weapons in the third world.
You said that there are new markets opening up for arms, the Pacific Rim, for instance. Which countries did you have in mind, and why are they interested now in acquiring more weapons?
The countries with the greatest increases in defense spending in the 1980s are largely in the Pacific Rim, countries like South Korea, Taiwan, Thailand, Singapore, Malaysia, Indonesia. These countries have experienced a considerable increase in their national income as their industrial strategies have proved so effective. And along with rising income, they want to have stronger defense forces.
Well, another thing that's happening right now is that the United States is trying to rethink its nuclear strategy. There was a military advisory panel that recently urged the president to respond to the breakup of the Soviet Union by having American nuclear weapons targeted at every reasonable adversary around the world. Can you elaborate on what this nuclear doctrine would be?
Well, this is an attempt by Air Force officers and military analysts to come up with a rationale for retaining nuclear weapons in the post-Cold War era. It's the title of the report is The Role of Nuclear Weapons in the New World Order. And it tries to find a reason to keep weapons that many people think are no longer necessary with the end of the Cold War. That is our large stockpile of nuclear weapons. And the report suggests that emerging superpowers in the third world may someday down the road, decades from now, pose a significant threat to U.S. security, and we therefore have to retain an ability to attack them with nuclear weapons.
What's the status of this report? The report was issued. Bush has been advised. We haven't accepted this strategy yet.
No, this is an advisory report. It's circulating in the Pentagon, and no doubt there are other such reports that haven't come to light. But my sense from reading the Pentagon literature is that there are people within the military hierarchy who are really determined to preserve America's nuclear capability. This is seen as a hedge not only against third world countries, I might add, but also against Germany and Japan, against the risk that they may someday remilitarize in a very significant way, even acquire nuclear weapons, and pose a military as well as an economic challenge to the United States. So American strategists want to maintain the one trump card they see, which is our very large supply of nuclear weapons.
Looking back to the international arms market, now that the Soviet Union has disbanded, the Soviet Union isn't going to be selling weapons or sending weapons to its allies or other countries in the way that it once was. Who's filling that vacuum now?
We have to remember that the defense companies that were once under Soviet control are now under the control of the respective states that comprise the Commonwealth of Independent States. And this means, in the case of defense industries, largely the Ukraine and Russia. And these republics, or these states, are very eager to acquire foreign currency for their economic problems. And they're very actively trying to sell weapons in the third world. There are reports of Russian salesmen in the Middle East and Asia trying to sell what used to be Soviet weapons, but which are now being touted as Russian weapons, and they've apparently had some success. Another country that's trying to take up the slack from the former Soviet Union is China, which has aggressively been marketing its weapons in the Middle East and elsewhere in the Third World. And they see this as a valuable source of currency and as an opportunity to expand their influence in the region. And so there's been quite a bit of friction between the United States and the other suppliers in China, which has been reluctant up until now to curb its arms sales.
So how much of the economies of Russia and Ukraine do you think are going to be based on weapon sales?
My impression is that weapons are one of the few commodities that the newly independent states of the former Soviet Union have for which they can find an overseas market, for which anyone is willing to pay hard currency at any rate. Most other Russian or Ukrainian products are too poor by international standards to find customers in the world market. But that's not true for Russian weapons or Soviet weapons, which, while perhaps not quite as good as American weapons, are still represent the best that Soviet technology was able to achieve. So for that's one of the few products, I think, for which the Russians will find overseas customers. And thus it's going to be a very important part of their effort to garner hard currencies for their very troubled economy.
Michael Clare is defense correspondent for The Nation and associate professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, today we're going to consider the survival of Macy's and whether Magic Johnson can compete in the Olympics. There were harsh sentences handed down in El Salvador to the murderers of Jesuit priests, who were sentenced to the maximum 30 years. We'll discuss human rights in Cuba with someone who's just recently returned from there and get various views of settlements in the occupied territories in Israel from around the world. We'll also talk to John Pizzarelli, who plays jazz guitar, about growing up in a musical family.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. At the opening kickoff of the Super Bowl this Sunday, linguist Jeff Nunberg will be sitting in front of the TV set like everyone else, but he'll have the sound turned down.
American writers in baseball. What a roster you could put together of the literary boys of summer. Lardner and Thurber, Malamud, Roth and Updike, Coover, Kinsella, and another dozen or so in the bullpen. But come November, the field empties out. In fact, somebody who knew this country only from its serious literature might be surprised to learn that Americans play football. Don DeLillo makes an interesting point in his 1972 novel End Zone, which is one of the few good football books I know of. He says, football is the one sport guided by language, by the word signal, the snap number, the color code, the play name. But if that's true, you'd think writers would be drawn to the game. Maybe it's just the language of football is so graceless. It's a pastiche of all the excesses of late 20th century corporate style. Listening to a Super Bowl is sort of like reading a sales brochure for a performance coupe, a lot of numbing jargon and technical detail wrapped in hype and bombast with a Roman numeral stamped on the package. Football is formations with names like flex, 4-3, 3-4, 2-5. It's job descriptions like H-back, defensive secondary, and offensive coordinator. It's those slow-motion NFL crunch films peppered with the words impact and awesome. And it's this strange way of always talking about the ball as the football, as in they're going to have to come back next quarter and show they can run the football. You don't hear this in other sports. Announcers don't say, Strawberry's been having trouble pulling the baseball, or Bird looks left and flips the basketball off to Paris for an easy two. But evidently the football is too solemn an object to permit familiarities. Now, none of this is an impediment for a writer like DeLillo. He's made a specialty of finding otherworldly rhythms in the metallic language of fast food menus, nuclear strategists, and assassination buffs. In End Zone, he mixes play calls and play-by-play into something that comes to sound like a cross between cyberpunk and Kool Moe Dee. Blue Turk right, double slot, zero snag delay, monsoon sweep, string in left, ready right. Hobbs hit Deering on a pony out for 9. He worked the other sideline, and Spurgeon Cole was forced out after picking up 13. Hobbs came back with an upflux draw to Taft that picked up only 2. But while this is a tour de force, it's music with a limited range. Mind you, there's nothing about football itself that requires this kind of language. When you come down to it, after all, it's a very simple game. Leonid Brezhnev was once taken to see a Redskins game in Washington. When a reporter asked him what he thought, he said, "All fall down, all get up. All fall down, all get up." That's pretty much the basic story. All the rest is commentary. And there was a time when the language of football was as elegiac and as corny as the language of baseball. This was back in the days of Hobey Baker and Grantland Rice, when people unapologetically referred to the ball as a pigskin. Fitzgerald caught the tone in This Side of Paradise, describing Amory Blaine's final game as a prep school quarterback. For those moments, courage flowed like wine out of the November dusk, and he was the eternal hero, one with the sea rover on the prow of a Norse galley, scraped and stripped into trim and then flung by his own will into the breach, finally bruised and weary but still elusive, circling an end, twisting, changing pace, straight-arming, falling behind the Groton goal line with 2 men on his legs in the only touchdown of the game. Now, I'll grant you this is a little ripe, but it's no more so than the baseball writing that Malamud and Kinsella are capable of when they go into extra innings. And unlike the modern language of football, its sins are forgivable. You can excuse yourself for feeling stirred by the Michigan fight song, but not by the music of Andrew Lloyd Webber.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist associated with Stanford University and the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. If you have any comments about Fresh Air, call our toll-free listener line at 1-800-NPR-WHYY. That's 1-800-NPR-WHYY. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis and Thad Kirk. Our show was directed today by Sue Spolin. Fresh Air's theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Donald Trump wrote a book called The Art of the Deal, but investigative reporter Wayne Barrett says that some of the best deals Trump made were with the politicians who pulled strings for him. On the next Fresh Air, Barrett talks with us about his new book, Trump, The Deals and the Downfall. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.